I suppose from our perspective, unfortunately, it's not surprising. I think that, you know, there has been a certain amount of complacency because over the last 18 months or so, there's been a sense that ISIS and Al-Qaeda have been somewhat retreating because of some of the successes in Syria and Iraq in particular. And I think that these recent tragic attacks show that these organizations are not retreating, they're regrouping. We've been quite, I think, tuned into this in Europe for the last period because we have encountered, you know, returning jihadis. We have encountered a huge problem with radicalization in prisons in Europe. And so we're very well aware that that these organizations are, you know, are reorganizing and are very much calling to arms their supporters and followers all over the world. And I think we see that in the spread of these attacks. And the fact that they coincide with what was in 2018 a spurt or a growth again in online terrorist content and radicalization. So, you know, this activity goes hand in hand, unfortunately, and we've been monitoring it very closely. And so, unfortunately, we're not surprised by it.
What do you see in terms of online radicalization, at least the status or the level right now? Has it changed? Has it dissipated? Has it increased? Or is it steady?
No, it's not steady. Unfortunately, it is increasing. I mean, we're seeing a number of developments. You know, one is that some of the best known names, if you like, of preachers who have been involved in radicalizing very well-known attackers, the likes of Anwar al-Awlaki, who has been effectively identified by most of the main platforms, particularly Google and YouTube, as being a problem. And they have committed to taking down his content. As you, I'm sure, are aware, his incitements to violence were certainly a factor in pretty high profile attacks.
Yes,
the
I'm
Pulse
also
nightclub
aware
shooter, the Boston Marathon bombers, to name just two. And his content is still available online. I mean, you know, on the one hand, the tech companies tell us that they're acting to remove this horrendous content, but at the same time, it pops up again and again. We've identified on YouTube some videos that have been there for almost an entire year, and yes, the platforms are just extremely slow to act.
Yes, so I'm also aware he's been dead for 10 years. So why is, in your opinion, that information still there?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, as we're aware, he's somebody who was identified by the U.S. government as being extremely dangerous, and he was ultimately taken out. But his propaganda lives on, and I guess that's the power of these online platforms, that somebody like that, who, you know, has caused so much destruction, can lose their life, yet their propaganda lives on. And unless the tech companies are held to account and actually deliver on the sort of the rhetoric that we hear from them repeatedly, we will see more and more of this. And I guess the concerning dimension to this is that it's not just the large platforms. It's not just, I mean, YouTube is one of the real offenders here, but it's also migrating to smaller platforms. And we see that in the planning of terror attacks as well. It's through messaging webs, platforms, through different websites, through document sharing and cloud platforms. So it's really, they're utilizing all of the tools available, and so it's really essential at this point that we don't simply just leave it to the private companies to regulate themselves, but rather we see some action from policymakers and regulators. And that's a huge part of our agenda now, and we've been doing it with some success, particularly in Europe, where the authorities, I guess, because of so many high profile attacks in the last 2 years or so, have really been taking it seriously and are now beginning to introduce regulation to try to restrict and oblige the tech companies to take action on this.
One of the things that you talked about, your organization, was the arrest of Peter Sharif recently, and the planning of the Charlie Hebdo killing. What did you make of the arrest of that, and how does that impact this process of what you're doing and what those that are fighting terrorism are doing?
Well, I think, firstly, the arrest is welcome, obviously. You know, it shows that international law enforcement can cooperate and, you know, achieve extradition orders and, you know, that the global system can actually, you know, work effectively to apprehend this type of dangerous individual. I suppose what we hope will happen is that, you know, it'll be possible for the French authorities to glean more information from him over the course of his interrogation and through the course of his prosecution to really understand more about the network that he was involved in. We know that he had, you know, very, very strong and identifiable contact and links with the individuals who perpetrated the Charlie Hebdo attack and also the attack on a kosher supermarket in Eastern Paris. At the time, they were linked. He is allegedly responsible, and according to French intelligence services, he was responsible for recruiting and training, or at least facilitating the training of those individuals in Yemen. So, you know, it's about joining up the dots and really understanding the patterns in terms of how they communicate, how they plan and plot, and also how they engage, I suppose, in the early stages of radicalization and activation of these individuals. This is, you know, this is something that I think pretty much, you know, every government in the world is trying to come to grips with, you know, to a greater or lesser extent. Obviously, the problem is more acute in some countries. And France has been, you know, has had a real problem with this for many years. So, you know, I think that there is a lot that can be gleaned in terms of what of his particular case, but also how it fits into a bigger pattern. And, you know, in France, we're working very closely with the authorities there, with the intelligence service there. But we also are currently working on a really deep dive analysis of what's happening in the prison system in a number of countries across Europe, including France, because they have one of the highest populations in their prisons of returning fighters from Syria and Iraq. So to really understand what's happening there, how they're recruiting and radicalizing others in France, you know, a lot of these terrorists are homegrown terrorists, and they're bringing back the ideology from abroad and then propagating it both indirectly through social media platforms, as we've discussed, but also in person in these prisons. And I think there's a lot of best practice that we need to really understand, and I think it can be applicable on both sides of the Atlantic. But so far, you know, there really isn't a huge amount of information available or a huge amount of analysis, and that's something that we're contributing to in our work, particularly looking at the prison system.
That's Lucinda Creighton. She's a senior advisor with the Counter-Extremism Project. J.J. Green, WTOP News.